The EU has announced a new round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic for how it has dealt with rioters who have threatened Iran's national security. Now, aside from its sanctioning high-profile Iranian politicians and important figures, it has also sanctioned Press TV International on the grounds that it aired, quote, forced confessions of detainees. Ironically, Press TV has not aired any kind of alleged confessions, forced or not, putting into question not only the sanctions themselves, but the credibility of the EU. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the EU and respective countries within the bloc are guilty themselves of human rights violations, forced confessions, and torture. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Host at Press TV's Hidden Files program, Marzia Hashemi, joins us here in the studios. And also host of Press TV's Mideast Stream, Marwa Osman, joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Marzia, welcome. Marwa, welcome.
You.
I'm going to start first with you, Marzia. Looking at the sanctions that the EU has leveled against Iran, aside from the figures, whether it's government officials or what have you, I'd like to focus on Press TV's sanctioning by the EU, accusing Press TV of these forced confessions of detainees, something which, as far as I'm aware of, where I'm active also as a presenter, we did not do something like that.
Right.
So first, your reaction of the sanctions themselves, and then on that premise, which at this point lacks credibility.
I'm not surprised, Kaveh. It's not the first time that we have seen various acts against Press TV based on nothing. But what it tells me is that we are being effective. Because if we weren't being effective, they wouldn't be so aggressive. We've seen them shut down our YouTube channel. We've seen what they did to our PressTV.com. So obviously, despite our limitations, meaning budget-wise compared to we see all the Farsi stations that are beaming in from outside the country and how much money that they put into what they're trying to do, obviously we cannot even begin to compare with that. And despite us being one station in English, one station, look at how aggressive they are based on nothing. And this is really important because when they talk about freedom of speech, I mean, they're lacking the basics right there. Shouldn't they have to at least explain? Shouldn't they have to prove it? Press TV has said, okay, show us. Show us what you're talking about, what you say that we're guilty of. But they don't have anything to show. But it doesn't matter. It's not based on substance, and it never had been. This is really media war. And unfortunately, they've never played on fair grounds. They're just trying to silence our voice.
Okay. Two key words there that I'm going to throw at you, Marwa Osman. First of all, is the adjective that Marzia Hashemi used, the aggressiveness that and the force of that aggression that's being displayed through the way that they're transferring what they want to transfer. Secondly, is the fact that we're looking at, and you as a journalist, I'm sure perhaps can give us some insight, is this is not just a coverage to cover, let's say, protest or what have you. There's a design, there's a system that appears from these, for example, British or UK state-funded TV broadcaster, BBC Persian, or the Saudi-funded Iran International. They have a system in place with a goal that they want to achieve, which is multifaceted. Perhaps you can tell us. Do you agree with the fact that this is something that's pre-planned with a certain goal in mind?
Oh, definitely. It's just one big package that has been financed and funded ever since the revolution in 1979 in Iran, and ever since Iran had a very impactful and very important role in bringing about the axis of resistance in West Asia and defying neocolonialism and imperialism in our region, but specifically against the Islamic Republic of Iran because of what its ideology is based on, of what its basic regime. And when we say regime, it's not the regime that the West actually uses. We're talking about the system that's founded inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran ever since the revolution up until to this moment. This media frenzy that's going on, this kind of warfare that Marzia spoke about, for me, I see it as some sort of a new type of occupation. They are occupying us even in waves and frequencies on the media and in mainstream media or in social media or on online on the web. They are trying to occupy the space and not allow us to have our own space. This is a new form of occupation. It's a new form of hegemony. It's a new form of attack and aggressive warfare of information that they are trying to take away our right of not only freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of the press, but also our right to tell the story as it is from inside of Iran. Because now the media frenzy in the Western world is speaking about Iran hanging or killing 14,000 Iranians. They are speaking about numbers that are beyond pathetic, beyond clown behavior as media. They don't want to even hear what's coming out from the ground in Iran. And this is the role of Press TV, being an Iranian media from inside of Iran, speaking the voices of the Iranian people that have been suffering, suffocating under unilateral punitive measures since 1979 up until now, suffering because of the warfare of the military bases that are surrounding their countries, of the insurgents that are now being infiltrated into Iranian borders, coming with the fund, the training, and the support of the West, specifically Britain, the US, and some European countries. At this very vital moment in Iranian history, they want to silence once and for all the only English voice that's coming out as a broadcast company from the Islamic Republic of Iran. But they really cannot take that to another level, sure, because we also have our space that we will not, we will withhold, we will stand steadfast in it, and we will defend our right to speak the truth no matter what happens. But the truth also is that they are powerful. Okay. They have the tools to try to manipulate the public, especially in the West. And our role here is to portray the truth and nothing but the truth that's going on inside of Iran.
Okay, that's pretty much what they are doing. This whole notion of manipulation is, of course, I think it's been taken to another level. You can perhaps tell us better, Marzia, in the way that they are trying to portray this image and paint this landscape of a revolution that's in the making here in Iran. That's what they're trying to do.
Right.
And there's many ways of describing this for lack of time, whether it's interference in other countries' affairs, et cetera, we know that, or using the media as a political weapon, perhaps. But there are regulatory bodies that are supposed to monitor this, and I have to ask you about Ofcom. Where is Ofcom?
Yeah, indeed. Where is Ofcom or other regulatory bodies? You know, Kaveh, it's interesting. In this hybrid war, we are seeing all kinds of things. They're trying their best and from various directions to bring down the Islamic Republic. I read an interesting article. It was quite unbelievable today. In Newsweek, I just want to give you a sample of what is being done. Now, Newsweek, of course, for those who do not know, an American news magazine, a very popular one over there, and it had an article in dealing with Iran, basically giving hints or complete direction of how to bring about what they call regime change. So we are transcending from a so-called news organization that's supposed to report on the news and actually saying, I really want to read some of this because I just want to be exact and quote what they're saying. Because it says, here's a plan to weaken the regime. First, Israel should intensify its economic pressure through a campaign of influence operations inside of Iran. Then it talks about the goal of the influence campaign should be creating a massive currency crisis that forces the regime to spend down its foreign currency reserves and increases the number of angry Iranians who take to the streets. That's just a sample of so many other points that the writers bring out in this article. What is this? Where are the regulatory boards?
CIA guidelines.
Where are the regulatory boards? Why aren't they saying, this is economic terrorism. This is totally economic terrorism. So they are propagating, creating economic terrorism. This is what they're trying to create on the ground. So where are the regulatory boards when it comes to these type of incitement? And this is what we have seen throughout this 2 months.
Indeed. One of the things that really stands out, Marwa Usman, is the fact that you have these interviews that are taking place. First of all, I think, again, as a journalist, I ask you the question where you can see that they want a continuity. So they have to pretty much highlight anything that they construe as a protest, whether it's a couple people walking down the street or maybe 10 or 12 people, depending on the angles of the cameras, etc. The continuity, however, is broken up by the interviews that they have. And the interviews have been with terrorist groups. From what I'm looking at over here, these terrorist groups are varied in terms of the ones that, based on stats now, in just 50 days, this would be the Saudi-funded Iran International, 25 terrorists and secessionists that appeared for more than 120 times in a matter of 50 days. And the groups including Abdullah Mohtadi, the leader and secretary general of the so-called Kamala Party of Iran and Kurdistan, Mustafa Hijri, leader of the so-called Democratic Party of Iran and Kurdistan, and the list goes on. Of course, again, these are terrorist groups, and yet, again, the regulatory body has no monitoring of this, and it allows this to be aired.
First of all, what Marzia read was very important for the people to see that they are CIA guidelines. These are the regime change guidelines that the CIA spreads across the targeted countries that they want to pinpoint their focus on and try to change the regime there. I could tell you this is just another page from the regime change book. I can give you the names of Mohaisni, for example, of Mohammad Julani. This is the same book that was going on in Syria, and they gave them platforms on multiple news media outlets, especially in the Arab world. I can name a few of them, but basically the terrorist groups, for example, inside Syria or in northeastern Lebanon, also had a lot of broadcast time on these same TV channels that you mentioned, and even more, especially in the Arab world, spread all across the map of the Arab world. This is just this typical another day, a 101 manual of regime change for them, utilizing the media as part of this warfare. And it wouldn't even surprise me if they go ahead and start with the actors, the crisis actors, and they would also go to hawks and to some sort of a sham that they would create, similar to what happened, for example, in Syria with the Khan Sheikhoun thingy, and also what happened in Lebanon and South Lebanon when Lebanon was being bombarded last year in 2021 by the Israeli entity. They utilized some of their insurgents to capture resistance fighters in southern Lebanon and portray to the world that the South doesn't want the resistance, when in fact it was just one or two people with a camera trying to portray that this is what the population and the public wants. I'm not surprised, and I wouldn't be surprised if they go further with such media manipulation, because it is part of the guidelines and the manual, the 101 book to regime change. But the issue is, it's just the definition of insanity when you repeat the same thing and expect different results. I mean, they failed in Lebanon, they failed in Syria, they failed in Iraq, and now they are failing miserably in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And at the same time, they are trying to hush us, to silence us, not to tell the world what's going on, the reality, to expose them, and then tell them that, no, the Islamic Republic of Iran is not in shambles, it is not weakened, it is not losing its momentum and its threshold against imperialism and neocolonialism and the unilateral punitive measures that they are putting forth, and to tell them that yes, there is some sort of a difficulty in the economy, but at the end of the day, Iran has many friends, and it is trying to make use of that friendship, especially in Eurasia. So sure. They don't want the public to know what kind of shenanigans they are playing in our part of the world, because they want to portray it as an undemocratic and authoritarian, a non-human rights defender country, a country that doesn't respect women, despite the fact that the respect that women get inside of the Islamic Republic is not found in all of the allied countries in the Persian Gulf Arab states that are allied to the West. It's not even an inch found there. But at the end of the day, they are silenced because they get benefit from the oil and gas from the Persian Gulf Arab states.
Sure.
But Iran is still independent. It's a sovereign state, and they don't like it. They don't like the fact that it's a strong, independent state. They want to see it broken, but it's not going to happen.
Sure. Well, we got a glimpse of one of the outlets, the state-funded BBC's Persian language, where one of the senior presenters there, I'm not going to name her because she has done her part in terms of speaking against Iran and its government, but through a leaked phone call, we understood what the Saudi-funded Iran International is all about, what it wants to do. It was very interesting reading down some of the comments aside from the leak of how all of a sudden you see it was kind of like a division there from the people saying, really? And then they kind of a reality check as to that's the goal that they have. They want Iran to be broken up into pieces. When you have that as a goal, and we understand that this may be spreading with other journalists who are working for these two organizations who have this obviously intention, that then the lines become blurred for the unfortunate people whom they were able to influence. Do you think we're going to see more of that coming about in terms of people realizing that the path they're going down is wrong, whether outside Iran or within Iran?
Right. Well, I mean, this has been such an aggressive propaganda campaign internationally, as we know from the very beginning, and the number of tweets that originally tweeted that individual's name, Mahsa Amini, to just getting stars and famous people from all over the world involved. And it's quite amazing, as if, you know, one Iranian female is that important, especially to the West. But I do believe that we're going to see more people becoming aware. To be honest, this is not something new. I mean, since I've been following Iran and things that have happened since the revolution as a college student, as a college journalism student, and it started then. From the very beginning, they actually started negative propaganda about the revolution. It won't last. It will not make it. It won't last 6 months, 1 year. There was always something. So for someone my age, it's total, you know, by the playbook. It's nothing new. For perhaps some of our young people in their teens, early 20s, they may believe initially this nonsense about freedom. And especially when they try to use women, they bring in the females. I mean, interestingly enough, as you know, Kaveh, this is a country where 60% of our university students are females. So tell me, how can these women be so oppressed if this is the reality in this country? And we live here. We know what is happening. I'm an American, and I have chosen to live in Iran, as a matter of fact, one, because of the safety, the security, which they're trying to destroy, trying to take away from us, and also because of the respect that actually people have for women. Yes, Iran has its problems like anywhere else, but it's far from, for example, my native country, the United States, where the systemic problems take place, especially when we're talking about police violence. So the hypocrisy is shown more and more every day, and I'm hoping that our young people, well, some of our young people, because I think the majority of them really understand what this is about. This has been about this from the beginning, the destruction of the Islamic Republic, the destruction of the lifestyles that we have. Yes, we have economic pressure because of the sanctions, but in general, we have a very calm life in Iran. Security has been everything, and that's what they're trying to destroy right now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, that's a great point that you make. Perhaps it's a point that is forgotten by some of the people and rioters that are out there on the streets there, Marwa Osman. But the mere fact that you have, and this is something that's known, but it should be, I think, advertised more, is that whatever gripes or problems the initial stage of the protesters had and were bringing out to the streets. Do you agree that that was stolen when there was the acts of violence, when there were ambulances that were being torched, or perhaps stores that were being lit on fire, and these burning of posters, etc., and things of that nature that obviously were all about violence, that was the beginning of the end for the people who had some problems, wanted to be heard, but it was overtaken by them?
Definitely. Again, this is by the playbook. You can see it in Beirut. It happened in Beirut in October 2019, when people were really mad at the government who stole from the actual public and went down to the streets. And it took like 6 or 7 days for the people to realize that what was going on was not what the public wanted, which made the streets empty again. And only the only available parties were those who were breaking down Beirut. And this is exactly what happened in different provinces in Iran, where you had people who had some demands. They wanted their voice to be heard at the first couple of days, and then vandalism, rioters, killing of police officers who did not even have weapons on them. They didn't even have guns on them, in comparison to more than 1,200 American civilians killed in 2022 by police officers before even being arrested. That's not even including protests or marches, just civilians going on with their daily lives, trying to be citizens, killed on the spot by the police. The exact opposite happened in Iran, where police officers trying to regain control of the situation, trying to bring back safety to the Iranian public, were killed. Their throats were cut. They were killed in the most brutal ways.
Indeed.
And despite the fact that they were trying to protect their country. And this was done by insurgents who were trained, who were funded, who were given guidelines as to what to do, what to attack, what to target, who to target, and how to create organized chaos in the streets of Iran. But what the world doesn't realize, that this is not, we're not talking about another of their authoritarian friends in the kingdom regimes, where oppression is really used against the public. This is a nation that has law, that has parliament, that has institutions that works for the public, by the public, which
thanks for that.
Will not be...
Sorry to jump in. I got to give Marzia 40 seconds. Mm-hmm. Iran's patience is up to a point, and it's going to run thin.
Yes.
How can it counter non-military method what's the onslaught through the media and through online posts against what it obviously perceives as its enemy?
Right. I mean, it's very difficult, indeed. Iran has been patient, and the people have been very patient, especially when seeing these security officials and so many regular people just being killed and tortured, not in a way that any one regular person would do some things. I think that as the people become more and more aware, and we in the media have to become more aggressive, showing the reality of what is happening on the streets, the pluses and the minuses, and also showing the reality of these Western-funded media that want to bring down the Islamic Revolution.
Thank you for that, Marzia Hashemi. It's all the time we have, host of Hidden Files. And Marwa Osman, thank you, host of MidiStream. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikava Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight.
News headlines on Europe's energy crisis may shock everyone, but the reality is much worse, as winter is coming and European households are dealing with high energy costs. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, European countries are preparing to face a severe and tough winter as the energy crisis further escalates amid the worsening Russia-Ukraine crisis and the explosions of the Nord Stream pipelines, while the U.S. is trying to use high energy prices to further weaken Europe's economy and force manufacturing industries to escape from the continent, said experts. They noted that EU leaders need to consider carefully of the future of EU-US relations. The analysts also said the EU can only ensure a sustainable peace and development of the continent when it keeps solidarity and independent policymaking. Chinese analysts recently said that some EU countries, especially major EU economies, purchasing energy from the US with extreme high price is a situation forced by the geopolitical crisis rather than normal business deal following market law. So it won't be sustainable, and in the future, EU nations are paying efforts to diversify their energy dependency to other countries rather than binding too tightly with the US. French President Emmanuel Macron said recently that European nations should join Asian economies to demand that the US and Norway show greater friendship by selling gas at lower prices. Addressing a conference of entrepreneurs in Paris, Macron said countries sanctioning Russia are united as freedom fighters but divided as producers or consumers of the fossil fuel. France intends to raise the issue with the G7 in particular, he said. The gas market doesn't really exist at the moment, the French president said, adding that leading economies should try to return it to a price corridor that makes sense. Wang Yiwei, director of the Institute of International Affairs at the Renmin University of China, told the Global Times recently that the high energy prices will surely divide the West, because it's very clear that U.S. energy companies are using the crisis to get rich, and the high prices will directly hit the EU economy by increasing the cost for the manufacturing industries. In the future, with the worsening of Ukraine crisis, more and more manufacturing industries will flee Europe and move to Asia and America, and then the Europe's economy will be hollowed out. Now, due to the governmental subsidies, the ordinary people's daily lives don't see major change. But in the long term, the high debts and the weakening national strength will eventually impact the people's livelihoods in the continent, Wang noted. There is nothing much that the EU can do to stop the crisis at the moment. Even EU elites clearly understand US strategy of using the Russia-Ukraine crisis to weaken its major economic competitor, the EU said, analyst. The internal divergences make the EU unable to jointly handle the crisis as a strong and solid power, they noted. The energy crisis is now impacting more and more major EU economies. Central heating will be restricted in Italy this winter as it becomes the latest country to take action on European gas supply shortages sparked by the Ukraine crisis. Under a new government decree, buildings in Italy will face an extra 15 days without central heating, according to media reports. The proposals include a cap on gas prices backed by the majority of EU countries, but opposed by Denmark, Germany, and the Netherlands, which worry it would make it difficult to buy the gas their economies need and curb any incentive to reduce consumption, Reuters reported recently. Spain's energy minister, Teresa Ribera, told Reuters in an interview that the opponents of a gas cap needed to accept that Europe faces a disaster. While selling energy to Europe at a high price, the U.S. is also further hyping the danger of nuclear war in Ukraine that could bring doomsday destruction to Europe, and France has expressed its concern recently. The U.S. is not making efforts to ease the tension, but it uses the tension to spread fear and concerns over Europe. The U.S. wants to make Europe to look like a continent with great uncertainty and tough economic environment, and then the Europeans with talents and the capitals will emigrate to the U.S. to help Washington in handling its own economic mess. Choi Ho-jian, director of the Department of European Studies at the China Institute of International Studies, told the Global Times recently that the EU has already paid the prices for the crisis, because in front of the severe geopolitical problem, it has no capability to solve the problem independently, and it has to rely on the US, so the EU might see the economic losses as the prices that it must pay. Choi noted, but the EU wants the prices as limited as possible. EU leading members don't trust other countries, and they also don't trust the US, especially after Donald Trump's term. The EU has noticed that US will handle transatlantic relations on a realistic basis, and the US hegemony is declining, so Washington is getting less and less reliable. This is why the EU is seeking more diversified energy supplies from Africa and the Middle East. Meanwhile, RT reported turning away from Russian energy will lead to very deplorable consequences for the European Union, with up to 20 years of deindustrialization ahead, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said. In an interview with the TV channel Russia One, fragments of which were released recently, Peskov said the Americans are now making crazy money by selling gas to European states at exorbitant prices. He said, and Europeans pay them, thereby depriving their economy of competitiveness. Production is collapsing, deindustrialization is coming, and this will have very, very deplorable consequences for the European continent over probably at least the next 10 to 20 years. He emphasized that in the past there was a mutual balance, as Russia was interested in buyers of its energy resources as much as they were interested in Russia. However, Peskov argued the EU started to repeat like a mantra that it had to rid itself of its dependency on Russian energy, and this eventually resulted in the current situation. The Americans are selling gas at prices that are three or even four times higher than Russian gas, Peskov said, adding that the Europeans are making their economy less competitive as they pay such money to U.S. suppliers. Gas prices in Europe surged earlier this year in the wake of Russia-Ukraine crisis, after the EU and Western countries outside the bloc imposed sweeping sanctions on Moscow and began a campaign of cutting themselves off from Russian energy supplies. Gas prices hit record highs, leading to a rise in overall inflation on the continent. Earlier this week, Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo warned that the continent might soon face a significant reduction in industrial activity and social unrest if nothing is done to lower energy prices. Reuters, meanwhile, reported that the U.S. is now delivering more natural gas to the EU than Russia for the first time in history, but that American gas was 10 times more expensive than Russian supplies.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran insists that recent riots in the country were orchestrated by outside adversaries such as the United States. But EU foreign ministers meeting in Brussels on Monday took a different view. They have agreed on new sanctions against Iran, claiming the rioters are seeking freedom.
To support them, today the Council adopted another 31 listing under the Iran human rights regime.
The channel you are watching now, Press TV, has also been added to the EU sanctions list. Press TV management has vehemently rejected claims by the EU that the channel broadcast forced confessions from detainees during recent riots in Iran. EU officials have been asked to provide evidence to back up the claims, but it's already clear that will not be forthcoming, simply because it never happened. This latest set of sanctions follows similar measures against Iran taken by the EU in October.
Iran is geographically a very strong position because they can decide, okay, if the European Union is going to make life harder in terms of sanctions, we can close or threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. That means that Qatar, which is the principal supplier, I think about 70% of gas is coming from Qatar these days, will be stranded.
One EU minister says the new sanctions should not be allowed to derail talks around the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
I hope that this can be kept separated because the JCPOA negotiations, of course, it has a long history already, and I would say it's this close that we could get an agreement on JCPOA.
During a debate on human rights in the European Parliament a few days ago, the EU was accused of displaying double standards.
Europe has invaded and butchered millions, plundered and committed genocide, overthrown and murdered revolutionaries, backed brutal dictators, imposed murderous sanctions.
Amid growing economic turmoil in the EU, many experts claim sanctions against Russia have backfired. In other words, sanctions don't work. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A high-ranking Venezuelan delegation is in Tehran to take part in a joint economic meeting with the Islamic Republic. The purpose of the commission is to deepen cooperation in strategic areas as part of a 20-year agreement signed between the two countries.
This is the 9th joint economic commission, and as you know, representatives from both sides have identified potential areas of cooperation in different fields, including transportation, industries, agriculture, energy, science, and technology. We will be trying to find ways to facilitate trade between the two countries to boost bilateral relations in order to avert the consequences of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and Venezuela are two independent states that share common views about many regional and international issues, such as seeking independence, the right to self-determination, and a multipolar world order.
Nosotros lo que estamos mostrando es...
We care about the well-being of our nations. Our values are different from imperialistic countries. Now that our people and our governments are united, We can avert the U.S. sanctions and allow out countries to prosper through bilateral cooperation and a strong political and economic ties.
Part of our scientific cooperation and training includes ways to advance new trends in molecular biology, biotechnology, and proteomics for cancer treatment.
In Venezuela, we have been testing regenerative agriculture in order to avoid desertification. We have achieved excellent results, and now we are ready to share our experiences with Iran.
Iran and Venezuela signed a 20-year cooperation roadmap during a state visit by President Nicolas Maduro to Tehran in June 2022, as the two oil-rich countries sanctioned by the U.S. pledged to boost bilateral ties. The 9th Joint Economic Commission of Iran and Venezuela will be going on for another 3 days. It is expected to pave the way for implementing the cooperation agreements signed between the two countries in different fields. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Last winter was devastating for many Afghans, especially internally displaced families. Some lost their loved ones, while some were forced to sell their children and body organs to make ends meet. Yet this year, the UN Refugee Agency warns that the coming winter will even be more deadly and challenging for displaced people. According to the UN body, 79% of Afghans do not have adequate access to heating, and 79% households live in shelters that require repair. We are visiting a refugee camp in Kabul, where the people are struggling amid the looming cold season.
People here are facing many challenges. Neither the previous government nor the Islamic Emirate has taken any steps to address them. I know families here who are on the brink of starvation. They can't afford basic needs and struggle to survive. I wonder why the aid organizations are not reaching out to these families.
A woman who fled her house in Helmand during the U.S. war now lives in a cold shack, facing dire conditions. She says she uses plastic and paper wastes for cooking.
Look, I have no clothes, carpet, food, or home necessities. During the day, I have water with dried bread, even though I'm unable to chew. Look, this is my house. Its roof is so weak and perilous. Swear to God I'm suffering so much and facing numerous shortages. I don't know what to do. No one listens to us and no one hears our calls.
some 3.4 million Afghans are currently internally displaced, with the majority of them living in such temporary shelters. Some of these people say the war forced them to flee their homes, and therefore the United States is responsible to address their needs.
Indeed, the U.S. caused these sufferings and miseries. It's war in Afghanistan that killed and displaced people and widowed thousands of women. As a result, nearly 11,000 families have taken refuge in this camp. Today, it is their responsibility to help ease the lives of the war victims. The global community should help these people with relief aid, shelter, and protection.
Despite worsening humanitarian needs, the funding outlook for life-saving aid programs and assistance remains bleak, according to the UNHCR. People here are expected to have a tough winter. They're worried that they may run out of fuel if the global community fails to address their needs. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history.
Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Days after going to the polls, the United States remains in electoral limbo. Dozens of elections for the House of Representatives still remain undecided, while control of the Senate is also up in the air, as two narrow races are still counting their votes. Just like in 2020, multiple battleground states have had controversial outages of their voting machines and surveillance equipment, leading to more questions by candidates and voters about the integrity of America's elections.
It speaks volumes, and we see these problems happening everywhere. If you ask me, a very common sense solution is to stop using all this technology to vote, because technology is easily hackable. None of it's secure, despite what anyone wants to say.
Projections show that Republicans will take the House, while the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote next month. Democrats are trying to spin the idea that they could have lost worse as a positive outcome, but without definite results, political life is on hold with major consequences.
Going back to George Bush's own first election over Al Gore, you saw that it was in Florida, where George Bush's brother was the governor, that the ballots took forever to be counted in. So all of this technology, the oligarchy that we have even in America, these problems are not limited to the third or the second world. They're right here in America.
President Joe Biden indicated he will run for re-election, even though a recent poll showed that 72% of the United States doesn't want him to run, and that includes 56% of Democrats. Ex-President Donald Trump continues to separate himself from the mainstream Republican leadership, as he's expected to announce next week that he's running in 2024, refusing to wait until after the crucial Georgia Senate runoff vote next month. The latest inflation numbers barely edge downwards, meaning that the average American is now suffering from both economic and political instability. Mass layoffs, which had been delayed until after the election, have already started as the world keeps moving forward, even if America's electoral results do not. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter, but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
È la prima nave.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while 4 passengers with serious health difficulties were transferred to a French hospital. This is not the first diplomatic rift between Italy and France in recent years. In 2019, Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome for consultations, after then Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio urged members of the Yellow Vest movement to continue with a protest against the French government.
There is a clear resemblance between the rift that took place in 2019 and the present one.
Both cases are just a mere provocation on the part of nationalist, populist Italian executives. This tension between Italy and France is the result of the insubstantiality of the EU's migration policy.
While EU countries keep failing to collectively assume responsibility on the migrant issue, around 20,000 asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea since 2014, while tens of thousands are stuck in Libyan detention centers where torture, sexual violence and abuse are rife. Max Civili, Rome.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000. For example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary. They don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high, gas high, and because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it. And he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits. And the government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
Limelight. Widespread dissatisfaction of employees working for the British National Health Service, NHS, including a significant part of doctors and nurses who are going to resign in protest at the current situation, has put this complex more than ever in danger of bankruptcy. The British Medical Association, which has recently conducted studies on the healthcare system, has warned about the collapse of the NHS. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer has admitted the National Health Service is on the brink of collapse, but warned the struggling service will also need to play its part in helping fix Britain's broken economy. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt said there were massive pressures in the NHS, with doctors, nurses on the front line, frankly, under unbearable pressure. However, Jeremy Hunt claimed the service received a lot of money and we need to do everything we can to find efficiencies. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak vowed to prioritise the National Health Service in his first speech as Prime Minister, but the Times reported that the Health Secretary, Steve Barclay, did not want to ask for money for the service in the autumn statement. Sources close to Steve Barclay have denied this, but did not reject claims he wanted to find cuts. The General Secretary of the Unison Trade Union, Christina McKenna, has accused the Tories of deliberately running down the NHS.